It's simple. It's dumb. It's the podcast. Episode 9 of It's Simple, It's Dumb, It's the Podcast, where we talk about the music of Jason Lytle with friends and fans of his work. Today's guest is pretty special. It was someone I had hoped to speak with from the very beginning, someone who's seen the full span of Jason's career and someone who's probably spent more time with him than anyone else over the years. Today's guest is none other than one of Jason's fellow granddaddy rockers, Jim Fairchild.
Reserve your strength for the luncheons. Best reserve your strength for the telethons. Best reserve your strength for the World's Fair. Best reserve your strength.
Jim Fairchild is a guitarist and a songwriter. He's a member of Granddaddy, most notably, but he also spent many years in another well-known band, Modest Mouse. When he hasn't been touring the world with those two legendary bands, he's been releasing music himself, first under the name All Smiles, and most recently under the name Small Isles. Oh, and Jim also is director of A&R at Dangerbird Records, which is the label on which the software Slump on a Wooden Piano was just released last year. Anyways, as I mentioned, I knew that if I was going to do a podcast like this, I wanted to speak with Jim, and I still hope to speak with fellow rockers Aaron and Tim in due time. But coming into the interview, I was nervous about speaking with Jim, worried that something that I and many other fans care so much about might not be met with the same level of enthusiasm or fondness in hindsight. Well, I was so relieved that this worry was completely unwarranted and fabricated in my head. The warmth with which Jim shares particular memories can be felt throughout the entire interview. It's incredibly easy to hear his heartfelt perspectives and immediately realize that this isn't just a band. Anyways, let's get started and hear what Jim has to say about Granddaddy, Jason's songwriting, and a few other interesting topics we throw in along the way. Here's my conversation with Jim Fairchild.
I realized this when I was when we were on tour in 2017, right before Kevin passed away. You know, there was a lot. Granddaddy has represented so many things in my life, and our kid was just on the way, and I've been sober for 5 years now, so this was 4 years ago. It's like a year then, and there was like new forms of clarity coming into my head, and I remember this moment where I was looking around at all the members of the band, and I was like, holy fuck, dude, everything in my life comes from what we did together. Like seriously, almost everything comes from, you know, what we created. And there was such a tremendous sense of like satisfaction from that, and like love and grace and loyalty, but that's kind of too small of a word almost, you know. And but I was just so appreciative that this relationship had been kind of rekindled after, you know, Jason and I working toward it for a few years, and then of course when Kevin passed away, really suddenly I felt just so thankful that I had that epiphany at that moment, that I kind of didn't have it too late. And I just, I, And then I had to leave that tour early because Natasha, my wife, had just gotten pregnant with our son, Azul. We had just moved into this new house, and there was just so much going on at home. And I was going to have to have a substitute for part of that year anyway, because of my stuff with Modest Mouse. And so I let the dudes know, like, you know, I can't do the rest of this run. Natasha's at home alone in a new house, and she's like, morning sickness and all this stuff. But when Kevin passed away, I was so thankful that I had had that recognition before it was too late. Granddaddy is, in some way, I can point back to Granddaddy as being responsible for almost everything that's good in my life, you know, aside from my parents, obviously, but like it all comes from that. It gave me a life.
Yeah. I remember that tour, and looking at some of the things that were on social media, and it really seemed like everybody, even Jason, was really soaking it up and just loving that experience, which probably wasn't the case on some of those earlier tours, right?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't always the case. You know, you get older and you have the, if you're lucky, you have the ability to reflect on some of these things. And there has been a lot of reflection that's occurred. But when all this first started happening, you know, like, kind of everything was accidental. And, you know, like, Jason and I had been, before I was even in the band, I was in another band in Modesto for years before I joined Granddaddy. But Jason and I had talked about me being in the band, and I didn't do it because I felt super loyal to my friends who I was in this other band with. But Jason and I would play together, we would record stuff together, we would jam, and we would always talk about music and life because there were a lot of similarities in our lives, and we both had a similar appreciation for like composition and production and arranging, recording. And not a lot of people in Modesto were into that, or if they were, they weren't into the type of music that we were. And so the thing that we knew was that, you know, Jason was this incredible songwriter and that all of us loved hanging out. And then, you know, like going back to Under the Western Freeway, we rented this place in Coulterville. It was this 50-acre piece of property, and it had a 4-bedroom house, and we made a garden there and a ramp, and we paid like, I think it was $650 a month. And, you know, no one was assembling studios back then. It just wasn't done. And we built the studio, and I was out there like maybe 4 days a week. Jason lived out there about 60 miles east of Modesto. And so we were just always together. We made this music. Jason made these songs. We made this record. And then obviously the objective was there to make it as good as it could possibly be. But people heard it and they started tripping out, and all of these opportunities started unfolding. And there was definitely never any real like grand objective. There was no real understanding of the business at that point. We were just like riding that wave. And if you're just riding a wave, and I don't know, the only ballast was really the relationship between the five of us, you know, and there wasn't much else. So to your point, it all was moving so fast. And a lot of it was kind of, I guess, beyond our control would be a way of saying it, but it's a little more complex than that, but at least like not completely on our control. And that made for some, you know, uncomfortable situations. But there wasn't a lot of ability. And also we were just always fucking wasted. So there wasn't a lot of ability to really keep track of what we wanted out of it or how we felt about it. And in 2017, man, some of those shows, like, I remember two nights before I left, the show in Manchester was like, that was one of the most magical musical experiences I've ever had in either band. It was just, it was insane. And you know, just looking around, I was just doing that last few weeks that we were together in Israel and Texas, and then the first part of that European run. And I was so thankful.
So you joined the band in the mid-90s, and Jason's mm-hmm. songwriting was just beginning to kind of transition from primarily these early guitar-driven Granddaddy tracks. I'm thinking like back to even Prepare to Ball. And they were progressing into these songs. It would ultimately end up on, as you mentioned, Under the Western Freeway. What was your impression of Jason's songwriting in those formative years when he hadn't quite found his style just yet?
It was always there. I mean, there was never any question. Like, even if you take a song like Black Bats or Worship Pneumonia. Like, I think that Jason would probably be a little less inclusive of those, of his desire to have those songs in his canon. But, like, you could hear, as a person who's, you know, made songs and been in music for a long, long time, since the late 80s, since I was in my teenage years, you know, early teens, you could always hear where he was going to go with it. In the way that he arranged things, even before keys really became a part of his sound, like, you could hear the way that he layered guitars, that there was something greater in his imagination and in his potential. There was no doubt about that ever to me. And that was also, again, like, part of, you know, Jason and my, the fundamentals of our relationship, because, you know, it, I guess if I'm totally honest, like, you want to hang around with people who are better than you, you know, and he was definitely, like, the best songwriter, not only in Modesto, but, you know, he's still one of the best songwriters. And I mean, that's, most of my friends are songwriters, but he's still one of the best songwriters that I know. And you could always hear that, you know, like, Away Birds with Special Sound. Could hear that there was this trajectory that he was on. And, you know, I was always very happy to be a part of that in whatever way I could.
So even in recent years, after he's now established himself more so, he's at times, like, revealed that he has traces of self-doubt about, like, whether something is, you know, good enough, I guess. I'm curious to hear if back then, did you ever get that sense? For instance, did he ever, like, seek validation by using you or the others in the band as, like, a sounding board for the songs as he was evolving? I mean,
he definitely, I mean, he could answer that better than I could, but I would say that was probably a big part of my role in our band and his life or something, you know? I mean, I think every songwriter has that, but so yes, I think that I was that, and all of us were that. I think, you know, he would throw those out there, and then if it passed the filter of me or us, then he knew that it was something. He, you know, as much as Jason is, like, single-minded and knows where he wants to go with things and knows how he wants, you know, the arc of a project to go and to appear, he still, you know, as everybody does, man, everybody's part of a system, you know, like, and I think that even somebody is, like, because Jason, all of that stuff is, you know, he does it all. He's not one of those songwriters where there's, like, somebody like Isaac from Modest Mouse is a lot more he's in control of everything, but like there's a lot of reverberance within his creative nucleus that happens for him to get to the crux. Whereas Jason, it's like it's a lot more single-minded and singular. It's just the way that he works, but it's still part of a thing, you know, part of our thing, I guess.
Yeah, that's good. I was actually going to ask you about similarities between Isaac and Jason, because you've worked now with both, you know, two prominent bands in Granddaddy and Modest Mouse, each with, as I was going to describe it, a singularly focused songwriter.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Isaac, they couldn't be more different in so many different ways. And some of that gets pretty personal. So, mm-hmm. you know, I wouldn't want to go that deep into some of that, because it's just like it's relationships that I have with two people who I'm very, very close to and have a lot of history with both of them at this point. You know, like Isaac kind of vacuums up. Well, it also is very generative, right? But he kind of vacuums up what's around him and then shapes it into, and in terms of like all of our personalities, whether it's like Eric, Jeremy in the old days, or you know, lately Tom, maybe me, Russell, and even more people, Dan Gallucci for a while, Johnny Marr for a while. But he takes, you know, what's around him as raw material, I think, is a way of saying it. This is a little bit reductionist, so I don't want this to be like the definitive statement on Isaac's creativity, but he takes what's around him and he knows when something has a potential to be great, and then he shapes it into something great. Whereas Jason is more of like and Isaac's less of a traditional songwriter, you know. I would almost say Isaac comes from more of like a hip-hop approach, you know, where it's like, and I in no way is this meant to be in any way, because Isaac is, you know, certainly one of the best songwriters of our generation, top five easily, you know. But Isaac's a lot more like, you know, like a magpie or something, like cruising around over the landscape and going, that, I'm going to grab that and, you know, bring it into the shape of this thing, you know. Whereas Jason is more like a sit down at the piano or the guitar, come up with a chord sequence, the shape of a melody, the lyrical framework, you know. It's a lot more, I guess, traditional. And Isaac is less traditional.
Okay.
In the classic songwriter sense, you know.
Right. So let's talk about influences for a minute. I mean, at the time, as a Granddaddy fan, I don't think we quite understood a lot of the influences. But, you know, in the years afterwards, we found out that some of Jason's biggest influences are Beethoven and ELO and A-ha and Waylon Jennings. Mm-hmm. Just these, yep. On the surface, there's such a strange mix of influences. I was curious if the band members, was Jason always upfront with you guys as to what was driving some of these songs? And if so, like, what was your reaction to that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And also, like, those are shared influences, you know. Like, before I was even in the band, again, like, Jason and I were always playing together. We played music together a lot. And I did that with Aaron. But before I was even in the band, we had like this country cover band with me and Aaron, our friend Mark Haney, and John Garner. And we would just get together over at the Main L House, which is where part of what became Pretty Mess, part of that was recorded. I think each of us would come up with like three songs or something, country songs, and we would just all learn them and, you know, sit around in the living room and drink beers and play country songs. So it'd be like Waylon Jennings and Merle Haggard, Willie Nelson. You know, that was a big part of it. But then, you know, like, certainly when we were in punk rock is a big part of it, you know, like, because we were all skateboarders. So there's like definitely some Suicidal Tendencies and, you know, definitely some Slayer, some Metallica. That's all in there. But then in terms of like A-ha and ELO and those sweet like hyper perfectionist widescreen things, I mean, it's maybe a little, well, it's a lot like, you know, like if you can think about like being kids of the 70s, you know, what we were dealing with was like what was on the radio before we started going to shows and going to San Francisco and stuff. So it's like, and what are kids attracted to, man? Like melody. So, you know, the ELO and the aha, like that shit is just like, those are the ultimate melodies. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Neil Young also, like, there's that ethereal quality that Jason has in his voice. And I don't just mean the way, the similarities between his voice and Neil Young. I mean, there's this like lyrically, like the willingness to like make up words with Jason and worlds with like Neil Young. These are things that, you know, it's this quality where like, you know, Modesto, I mean, we're all from there and it forged us. But it's a place that you can't help but want to escape, I think, in a lot of ways. And so the only way that you can escape that is imagination at first, right? So that's like those sort of, those melodies, those big grand melodies, that's a way, that's a form of escape in a way, you know?
So you mentioned...
And Jason is so good at that.
Yeah. You mentioned Modesto. I'm curious, is the fact that you guys, you know, are from Modesto, did that somewhat make the story all the more remarkable that we have five average guys in you know, coming out of Modesto with no formal musical training that were able to accomplish what they did?
Categorically, 100%. Like, you don't get Granddaddy without Modesto. That is the crucible, you know, which forms it, which forms the band. And again, like, the collision of, you know, Jason's arrangement sensibilities is like forges this thing that is completely unique to us. And then also the way that we play, and again, the sound that we make together. And I don't know if we do things in the future, and Jason and I are kind of still undecided about that, I think, but it'll be interesting to see how that changes without Kevin. But there's just something about, again, like I just have to go back to that shared experience of all of us being from that place and the love that we have for each other. It contributes to the sound of that band in a way that could never be duplicated. You could put five people together, or let's say four other people with Jason, to do exactly the same things. And it's just not, there's going to be some, like, in maybe the 10 to 20% range that is totally identifiable. I can't identify it. That's going to be missing from that. It's not to say that the songs aren't going to be as good, you know, and that people wouldn't appreciate hearing him singing them. But there's this thing that only comes from us having grown up there and gotten out of there, you know, and that shared experience thing too, where it's like all of that shit, man, like, this is going back to something I was saying earlier, like we definitely wanted to get out and we wanted to go adventures and we wanted like redefine our existence, I guess would be a way of saying it. But the way that it all happened was pretty unimaginable to do like us. But Jason and I are working with this guy on putting this documentary together finally. It's something that's been talked about for shit, I don't know, 9 years or something. So he sent me this picture the other day, this guy Brandon who's working on the documentary. And it was the five of us in Chicago. I remember the day that we took it, we're all wearing baggy pants. But there's this thing, man, where it's like, you cannot, there's this quality that you can see in that picture that could only come with five people who have experienced all this crazy, unimaginable shit together. There's this unspoken language that will always exist between us, which of course is going to carry over into the music, you know. Mm-hmm. And and being from Modesto is a big, big part of that.
Right. Okay, so transitioning to something that's not so serious, but I'd be remiss if I didn't at least bring up the Arm of Roger, which was the pseudonym so used by you guys to record a fake album to prank your record label at the time.
Yeah.
You and Jason trading lyrics in 7 days of the week, like, kills me every time. I don't know. Some of that stuff is so funny, some of that shit.
I got beat up by my landlord because I hung out with his daughter and I was drunk, but I didn't even fucking do anything.
Tuesday. I call around to different barbers and ask if they can make me look like Danny DeVito, but with more hair, but younger.
Wednesday. It was actually Wednesday night. But looking back on this now, do the memories of this make you laugh or cringe?
I mean, when I listen to it, sometimes I do cringe a little bit, but it's really funny more than anything, because, you know, again, like, so much of Grandy was just reflexive. It's like, what are we supposed to do? Like, do our part to make great music. There was all this pressure from V2 during the making of the touring of Under the Western Freeway. I was like, you know, if this happened, then this would happen. It's coding, like the coding of rock and roll. If this, then this. So, you know, we thought, well, it'd be really fucking funny to, you know, give you guys this completely terrible fucking record and just let you sit with it for a little bit. So we actually, that record was done before we even started the Software Slump, before we even started the Signal to Snow Ratio. And it was just, there's something about that too that I wish we would have never lost sight of, which was just like that got us so far down the road in a way, just like, this makes no sense, but fuck it, let's do it. And because, of course, when you tell people that story now, or when I tell myself that story even, it's like, damn, that was a fucking wild thing to do and a very risky thing to do. But I don't think you get, you know, the granddaddies of the world without taking risks. And, you know, so that was one that we took, and it was really fun. And I have such great memories of, you know, like, there's that band Synergy song in there.
And maybe if you cannot play so loud, Mr. Play Loudy.
But that's what I mean. I'm not.
You can do some backups.
I'm still the lead guitarist, and that's what.
You know what?
I just think maybe we have to, like, break down all the walls for this record.
I hate every one of you guys in this band.
Maybe just all the walls have to be broken down, though.
Maybe
with me and Kevin and Jason, I can still remember that night so well. And I'm so thankful to have those memories, you know, with Kevin, with everybody, but with Kevin, because, you know, he's not here anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the Arm of Roger thing. And then, you know, once that story had, you know, the telephone game happens and it's like, did you really do this? And it gets amplified. And we just decided, like, well, let's just put it out. Like, so we had this little label called Sweat of the Alps during the Someday record. The only records we ever put out were Arm of Roger and the Built Like Alaska Hopalong record. But we're like, let's just make it available to people. And it turns out we sold a lot of copies of that. I think we sold, like, just on our own, you know, like 5,000 CDs or something. And then, you know, we spent so much time on the artwork for that and the website for that, because we kind of never, the creative part of it, we never did anything half-assed. There was never a moment where, like, we just kind of tossed out ideas, whether it was the visual stuff or even a prank. Like, we spent time on it.
That's funny. So one more question that I had was on a more serious topic. So the idea of the Software Slump on a wooden piano, it was just released just last year. And the concept was credited by Jason to you after you recalled to him how the songs were originally unveiled to you by Jason on a piano all those years ago.
Yeah.
When you were hearing those songs for the first time, did you have any idea how significant those songs would ultimately become?
I mean, no, not in the sense of what they became, but there is, you know, I would encourage anybody who does anything creative and definitely music, you know, let, this is such a like kind of corny aphorism, but I'm just going to say it, like, let your, if you get anywhere in this shit, let your internal compass be your guide, which is to say that when, you know, when we were, so Jason and I were making Signal to Snow Ratio, which we, you know, that was kind of like the way that we tried out the recording gear to make the software slump. I knew that something that there was, that we were like leveling up, to employ modern parlance, like, that there was a significant step forward happening. I could sense it then. And then once we got done with that, I was really eager. I was like, well, okay, let's move on to the record. And Jason wasn't ready. And I'm sure I was giving him pressure that he didn't want. I didn't have the sense of self or what my relationship was like with him at that point to even know that that was unwanted pressure. Anyway, I was like, let's go. And he wasn't ready to go. And then finally, he says he doesn't remember this, and he probably doesn't remember it. I'm kind of cursed with a really good memory in a lot of respects, but I remember being over at that house, which we called Little Portugal, in the orchard, and him saying, okay, I'm ready. I can play the whole record now on piano. And he sat down, he played most of it. I don't think Broken Household Appliance, National Forest actually existed yet, but, and we got distracted anyway, but he sat down and played like the majority of the record in sequence, you know, and then we just got distracted by, you know, whatever else. But that's always been something that has stuck with me, because, you know, he had, again, such a like singular but also identifiable like shape of this thing. That's a super hard thing to do. And of course, when you're making a record, things start to appear, and there's always like trial and error that is informing the process. But he knew early on like how he wanted that thing to go. And so, you know, now I do A&R in addition to, you know, all the other musical stuff that I do at Danger Bird. And the 20th anniversary was coming up, and Jason and I were talking about what to do with it. And that was just something that I had to get out there. Like, you know, these songs, I mean, there's also a part of it where, like, I want, if the ability exists for Granddaddy to exist at all, I want that potential to be there. But I also think there's a part of Jason's creative life that maybe doesn't get quite as much shine or attention as, you know, I could imagine being the case for him. And, you know, I've spent, you know, thousands and thousands of hours of my life listening to him sit at a piano and sing songs. And I, you know, that's something else that I feel like other people would enjoy. So, like, what better way to do that than, it's not the genesis of that process, but it's one that we could point to as, you know, one of the founding moments or principles. So, you know, I wanted that to exist, or I hope that could exist. And when I brought it up to him, he was into it, you know.
Yeah. Well, I loved it. I loved the record. I thought it was great.
Yeah, he did such a fantastic job. Yeah. I'm so stoked that, you know, it was honestly better than I would have imagined it was going to be.
Yeah, I think my favorite's the Crystal Lake. It just took on a whole different kind of feel as a piano version. It's just crazy.
Yeah, I mean, the rock songs, you know, Charts and Graphs, Crystal Lake, Broken Household Appliance, National Forest, like those are my favorites of the wooden piano, just because, you know, again, it also just emphasizes what great songs those are. When you're playing on like big layers of multiple vocals and loud guitars, it's I think that sometimes, you know, you don't know what great songs those are, what great compositions they are. Mm-hmm. And they are. So
yeah,
let's talk about one of those great songs in more detail. You have one in particular in mind, right?
Laughingstock is kind of, it's the representation of that musically. Like it's the mission statement of Granddaddy. in every way, like sonically, structurally, lyrically. I mean, Jason addresses a lot of the stuff in there that is the band. We Do Believe It Ends Right Here. It's like it starts and stops with this. And we agree it's what we need. It's like that was our salvation, which is kind of a funny thing to say, but it really was. Like it got us out of what, you know, could have been a much different life. The other thing that I remember a lot about that song is in 2012, when we first started doing reunion shows again, so we hadn't played any music. The five of us had not ever been in the same room and played music since the summer of 2004. So I was living in San Francisco at the time, and Jason was living in Montana. He drove down. I drove over, and we met Tim and Aaron were working. It was a Saturday afternoon. And Tim and Aaron were working, and me and Kevin and Jason were just kind of jamming, and then the first song that we played together was Laughing Stock. It was just the three of us. So, you know, no drums and none of that keyboard and the big lush fake strings and stuff that Tim does. But still, like, I remember going like, holy geez, man, like, this is just the three of us. And there's something about the way that we all relate to each other. It's like shared experience or like unspoken love for each other or something like that. It makes this thing bigger than you could ever possibly. Then you could ever like write the recipe for those ingredients down, or like musical notation. And then the next day or later, they came that day, and it was the first song that we all played together as well. And it was the same thing. It was like just truly magic. And I've played that song hundreds of times, literally, and listened to it probably 1,000 times. But there's something about that song and the way that we all relate to each other that can be like distilled down to that song, in that song, that somehow represents Granddaddy in every way to me. I think it's one of the best songs Jason's ever written, but it's also just one of my favorite songs ever. I think it's just, I know everything about that song, and it still kind of is puzzling to me, which is the best place that music can put you in. I mean, it's the orchestra reel thing. It's like, what the fuck does that even mean? It's a made up word, but it puts you somewhere. And that's what the best songs do. know, Jason described it as like Neil Young meets like sci-fi. And there's talk in there, obviously with the song title Laughing Stock, but also just with the sort of repetition of drums. It's almost like a motoric or approach to rhythm. Like everything about Granddaddy is in that song to me. Mm-hmm. Going back to that experience of playing Laughingstock with those dudes for the first time in 8 years, it's a very simple song. Couldn't be simpler, you know, 1-4-5-6. Like, that's what the whole thing is. There's a suspended chord in there, which I'm really attracted to in the verses. But it's the simplest song in the world. There was this moment in 97 when maybe it was 96, I don't know, but no, it was probably 97, early 97 when we first started making that. And he had like this list of songs that he wanted to track, and Laughingstock wasn't on there. And I remember telling him, I was like, if you don't put Laughingstock on there, then I'm quitting the band. I'm done. Because I just always thought that, and I still, again, think that that's one of the best songs ever.
Okay, that brings us to the end. Special thanks to Jim for being so willing to talk to me. I mentioned earlier that Jim had just released some music under the name Small Isles. He and Jacob Snyder recorded The Valley, The Mountains, The Sea, and just released it this summer on AKP Recordings through Dangerbird. Here's one of those tracks, Life at One. Take care, everyone. Speak with you soon.